Across the Pacifica Network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 10, 2003. From the WTO Ministerial Meetings in Cancun, Mexico, I'm Deepa Fernandez. A Bush administration plan to roll back the 40-hour work week is dealt a serious blow in the Senate today. Congress continues the debate over the Senate Medicare bill and the proposed Equal Employment Opportunity Commission regulation. And as the official meetings of the 5th Ministerial of the World Trade Organization kick off today in Cancun, Mexico, we look at agriculture, one of the biggest issues on the agenda. We hear from farmers in Mexico and look at the GMO dilemma in Uganda. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israeli warplanes bombed the home of a senior Hamas leader today in Gaza City, killing two people and wounding 25 others, including children. The attack on Mahmoud Zahar follows two suicide bombings yesterday that killed 15 Israelis. Zahar survived, but his eldest son and bodyguard were killed in the attack. Mohammed Azam witnessed the airstrike.
I live across the street from Dr. Zahar and was passing his house when the F-16 dropped its bomb. Afterwards, I pulled him out of the rubble. He was well, thank God, and only had slight injuries. But the house was completely destroyed and all the floors fell on top of each other. As you can see, there is no way of telling that this was once a house. Khalid, Dr. Zahir's son, was killed, as was his bodyguard, Sheda Youssef El-Dairi.
More explosions were heard in the region late this afternoon. As we go to press, the Israeli daily Haaretz is reporting IDF helicopters and tanks have fired in southern Gaza. In the West Bank, Palestinian Parliament Speaker Ahmed Kouraya, also known as Abu Allah, accepted the job of prime minister, filling the void after the resignation of Mahmoud Abbas. Kouraya said he would form a crisis cabinet of no more than 8 ministers and seek parliament's approval Thursday. Dr. Moshe Bahar is the director of the Alternative Information Center in Jerusalem. He says that it's evident that Kouraya's term will be a failure.
The problem that we're experiencing here is simple. The root cause of the violence that is happening now, as well as the problem that we experienced at least 1667, is not addressed. As long as the root cause is not addressed, there's no magician that can solve the problem, and unfortunately I think that Abu Allah is going to follow the steps of Abu Mazen, and I don't think that he has even a little chance to succeed. That's tragic. It is tragic because people that actually pay for all of these unwise steps that, of course, the U.S. is also responsible for, the people that pay for it is really working-class civilians. That's both Palestinians and also Israelis.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has cut short a visit to India, closing the Campesino Forum in Cancun today that brought together thousands of peasant farmers from Mexico. Was the first march of the first day of the World Trade Organization's 5th Ministerial. From Cancun Independent Media Center, Renee Feltz brings us the sounds of the streets outside the meeting.
While trade ministers struggle to find agreement inside the WTO meetings today, outside, a cross-section of international opposition to the trade talks found consensus. An estimated 10,000 people, peasant farmers from Mexico, rice farmers from Korea, and young activists from around the world, filled the streets as they marched into the red zone where talks are being held. Ferdinand Gait, president of a Filipino government employees union, sums up some of the message from today's march regarding the effect of the WTO on jobs and social services.
Our concrete experience so far has been that instead of the promise that privatization would improve services, it has greatly deteriorated the prices of rates provided by the capitalists who now control these services have greatly increased to the detriment of the marginalized sectors.
From Cancun Independent Media Center, I'm Renee Feltz.
Shell Pipeline Company has stopped plans to reactivate a nearly 50-year-old pipeline. From New Mexico, Joe Gardner-Wesley reports.
The idle pipeline runs 400 miles and goes immediately past a community center and elementary school in the growing community of Placitas. Activists there campaigned against restarting the line, especially after a pipeline explosion in southern New Mexico killed a family of 12 in 2000. Shell had planned to run volatile fuels through the 48-year-old line, but it said it could not get enough customer commitment to make the plan economical. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley in Placitas, New Mexico.
Argentina has officially entered in default with the International Monetary Fund. Yesterday was the deadline for repayment of the $3 billion debt that was largely incurred during the military dictatorship in the early 1980s. Pauline Bartolone has the story.
The government led by Nestor Kirchner said that they will not hand over the money unless an agreement is reached. Even though the United States declared that the fund should show flexibility, the arrangements haven't been made. The IMF is concerned about three things. First, how and when to recapitalize the country's ailing banking sector. Second, they want to establish a mechanism for deciding how to set targets for the primary fiscal surplus, the surplus excluding debt payments. And finally, they want a law by the end of this year granting price increases for the mainly European-owned utility companies. To reach the IMF demands, Argentina would have to cut many of the remaining social benefits and increase taxes. Kirchner knows that it is not going to be easy to do what the IMF is demanding without a major social crisis, including demonstrations and road blockades. Negotiations between Argentina and the IMF will continue. Reading for Pablo Biolo in Argentina, I'm Pauline Bartolone for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
A Bush administration plan to roll back the 40-hour work week was dealt a serious blow in the Senate this morning. By a narrow margin, senators lent their support to an amendment that blocks Labor Secretary Elaine Chao from amending the Fair Labor Standards Act. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the Labor Department's proposed plan would mean one of the largest pay cuts in history, as a net 8 million Americans would lose their right to time and a half pay. John Hamilton reports from Washington, D.C.
On this vote, the yeas are 54, the nays are 45, the amendment is agreed to.
The amendment would defund any attempt by the Labor Department to alter overtime classifications as defined by the Fair Labor Standards Act. That act, first passed in 1938, enshrines the 40-hour work week into law through the enforcement of overtime pay. Administrative, professional, and executive workers, however, are exempt from overtime protection, and the Labor Department is hoping to reclassify new categories of workers as exempt.
American workers right now already work longer hours than any industrialized country, and nearly all third world countries.
Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa sponsored the amendment.
Now we have the proposal by the administration rolled out this spring under cover of darkness, not one public hearing, nowhere in the nation. Changes in rules and regulations that will affect overtime protection for over 8 million American workers and their families.
It's not just office workers who would be affected. Senator Mary Landrieu, Democrat of Louisiana, says an analysis of the Labor Department plan projects a broad array of workers losing overtime rights, a disproportionate share of whom would be women.
Nurses, policemen, firemen, dental hygienists, postmasters, motor service carriers, preschool teachers, welfare eligibility workers, agriculture inspectors, zoning inspectors, conservation agents, white-collar workers.
Carol Bragg is one such worker. She's a cardiac care nurse from Gaithersburg, Maryland, who says that U.S. nurses, on average, put in more than 300 hours of overtime per year.
Employers have cut nursing staffing to the core, and that means we are routinely required to work mandatory overtime in order to cover inadequate staffing schedules. Without overtime protections, employers could demand us to work long, hard hours.
The AFL-CIO made the protection of the 40-hour work week a major priority this summer. The union umbrella group helped to generate hundreds of thousands of faxes, letters, and emails to the Labor Department, the vast majority of which were opposed to the changes. But despite lopsided public opinion on the issue, the White House has threatened to strike down the entire $138 billion spending bill on labor, health, and education due to Senator Harkin's amendment. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney.
President Bush has threatened to veto the entire bill, which funds critical programs such as education, Head Start, the NLRB, and OSHA, unless Congress allows him to take away overtime rights from 8 million workers.
Even if the White House is bluffing in its veto threat, the measure must first survive the House of Representatives, which in July narrowly shot down a similar attempt to block the changes. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
The World Trade Organization's fifth ministerial opened in Cancun this morning, with negotiators focused on reaching a compromise on trade in agriculture, seen by most observers as the main key to declaring success at the top-level international trade talks. On the table is a proposal from a group of 20 developing countries, including Brazil, China, and India, to ask the United States and the European Union to completely abolish export subsidies to their farmers to get access to southern markets. But as Tim Russo reports, many farmers from the north and south say this won't solve the problem.
The United States clearly defined its position for this week's negotiations when speaking to reporters at the WTO, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Anne Veneman.
We are here in Cancun with the same high level of ambition we had at the outset. We want to eliminate export subsidies, the most egregious form of trade distortion. We want to significantly expand market access. Our goal is to greatly reduce trade barriers that prevent trade and economic expansion.
John Ross, reporter and author who has been covering indigenous and campesino issues in Mexico for over 30 years, says that what market access really means is that multinational corporations like Cargill and Archer Daniel Midlands displace many poor farmers from their land.
ADM has gone into business with the Maseca Corporation, and so we don't have an entity in Mexico called ADM, but we have the largest tortilla purveyor in the country. Produces 80% of Mexico's tortillas, which is now owned a third by Archer Daniel Midlands. And, they want market access, you know. That's what this is all about, is market access. You know, there are two reasons for trade domination. One is resource and the other is markets. And this is the market side of the coin.
George Naylor, president of the National Family Farm Coalition from Iowa and member of Via Campesina, explains the implications of the multinational domination on trade agriculture.
Already companies like Cargill have big chicken factories in various countries around the world. So they buy our cheap corn and soybeans and turn it into manufactured feed that they can ship all over the world and feed their chickens, and then flood the markets of various countries with their cheap chickens and destroy their farmers.
Poor countries gathered here in Cancun say that they would be willing to open up their markets to the multinationals if the wealthy countries reduce the huge subsidies that the governments of the United States and European Union provide to their farmers, mostly to guarantee votes in national elections. However, even in wealthier northern countries, not all farmers benefit from this financial support. Paul Nicholson, a farmer from the Basque Country, expounds on this.
Our basic problem is that we come from a region where we are small family farms in a sustainable agriculture in a more mountainous area where there's no way that we can compete with the big multinational farming with low prices. We do a much more sustainable agriculture, small family farm based. And it's not possible on the market to sustain any sustainable agriculture.
These problems are mirrored in Mexico. Again, John Ross.
Mexican small farmers, many of the indigenous peoples, are being forced out of the internal market. They can no longer make a living growing corn. Farmers have abandoned their land, gotten in the immigration stream, and are coming home now in coffins from the U.S. 283 other Mexicans, I might say, died in the desert basically because they have been forced off their land. If we take that total of farmers, more Mexicans have died since NAFTA came into being in 1994 than died in the World Trade Center.
One such farmer is Rosa, not her real name, from Chiapas, who says that she has seen many families get poorer due to the free trade policies that have brought GM corn into Mexican agriculture.
This has everything to do with the free entry of many transgenic products which damage our countryside. And as a result, we have to survive with the low prices we get for our produce and also the destruction of our soil due to the chemicals.
President Vicente Fox kicked off the agricultural negotiations today at the WTO, which proves to be one of the hottest issues this week as thousands of campesinos were taking to the streets today demanding the WTO out of agriculture. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tim Russo in Cancun.
Meanwhile, as the world gathers for the World Trade Organization summit here in Cancun, Uganda is deciding on the use of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. Ugandan President Museveni recently gave the green light to the introduction of GMOs amid strong opposition from farmers. Ugandans feel that if the country introduces GMOs, it will lose the market for its agricultural produce in Europe, whose countries are still opposed to genetic foods. From Kampala, Uganda, Joshua Kalimpa has this report.
The summit has agriculture on top of the agenda. And the leader of Uganda's delegation, Dr. Kisamba Mgerwa, says Uganda's turn, like that of COMESA and the African continent, is a strong no to subsidies given to farmers in the developed countries.
We want to increase productivity and profitability of our produce. At the same time, the outlet easier for Uganda and many developing countries on the continent is Europe, which we are used to, which is the potential market.
Agriculture contributes over 40% of Uganda's gross domestic product. And according to government statistics, over 80% of Uganda's population are employed in agriculture. Yet, most of these farmers are below the poverty line, despite their hard work. Sobiri Muhammad is a Ugandan farmer from the rural district of Mukono.
We are in a bad state, very bad indeed, because nobody wants to come close to farming. For example, you buy seeds very expensively, thinking that the market price will be good, but when it comes to harvesting, the prices fall. This means that a farmer normally runs at a loss, and as a farmer, you cannot make advance plans for anything to do with the money. Farming is now like lotto. You either benefit or lose.
According to the World Food Program, over 1.5 million Ugandans risk starvation. And President Yoweri Museveni says that GM foods would eradicate this problem. However, Chebet Maikut, president of Uganda Farmers Federation, says genetically modified organisms are not the solution to Uganda's woes. He believes that Ugandan farmers have the capacity to produce using their traditional ways. But what they lack is a market for their produce.
I don't think that the president was well advised, in our opinion, to give an automatic okay to the introduction of GMOs in Uganda. Our view is very clear as farmers. Our strong recommendation to government is that we should go slow. Government should go slow with introduction of GMOs. The subject of GMOs is very controversial globally. We've heard so many stories, including the cases of Zambia, who rejected the GMO maize supplied by World Food Program. And we know that currently there are conflicts between USA and Canada on the one hand, and EU, again on the subject of GMO.
The US and EU have been at odds over the issue of genetically modified foods. But Uganda's Minister of Agriculture, Dr. Kibirige Ssebunya, himself an expert in genetic engineering, says Uganda will not be deterred from what he is calling the agricultural revolution.
Can Uganda engage in genetically modifying crops or animals? Yes. As a matter of fact, the other day we opened a high-tech laboratory, and we are hoping that we can use that institute to locally produce our own genetically modified organisms, plants, but under our own supervision and using the appropriate laws and legal framework that we shall be putting in place very soon. The row between the United States of America and the European Union is their own business. We don't know what they're quarreling about, but that has nothing to do with us. We are hoping that when we put the appropriate legal framework in place, that we shouldn't have any problems with continuing to export our materials to Europe.
To spearhead this research, an inauguration of a laboratory took place last week, and Uganda seems to be moving towards GM technology. Presidential advisor John Kakwenzire disagrees with the president on this.
Our farmers have never used fertilizers. They have never used pesticides thanks to the lack of exposure and money. So we are set to reap big from the organic market. That's why I would say, let's take advantage of the huge market. If you had asked me, because I know the potential of our people to produce without any of this genetic engineering, I'm advising my own people I'm in touch with to steer clear of things they don't know. I wonder if people have taken trouble to explain to the president the advantages and disadvantages of going into GMOs.
The president is determined to move forward with the so-called agricultural revolution, while critics believe the project is bound to fail. With farmers in the developed world enjoying subsidies from their governments, the only selling point for agricultural produce from poor countries such as Uganda is organic farming, because Europe, which is the biggest market, says they want organic products. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Chalimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Government officials and economists are saying the economy is improving, but that may sound hollow to the millions of workers who are currently looking for jobs. The nation has lost 2.7 million jobs over the past 3 years, and more than 1 million jobs have disappeared since the recession officially ended in November 2001. In Oregon, where the unemployment rate is the highest in the nation, workers still struggle to find jobs, as Mai Kim reports from Portland.
I need more job. I need more job.
Gunawan Muladi is one of the lucky ones in Oregon. He has a full-time job at Epson and has his own import business. Still, Muladi asks who is to blame for the lack of jobs. He thinks it's President Bush and his administration's policies.
Like my friend who works for social service, the agency is supposed to support the low-income family because of his decision, tax cut, and then nobody support them, like social service, like teen pregnancy and homeless. Who's going to take care of those guys? It's our people and our friend, our neighborhood. And his problem is my problem.
In Oregon, the situation is worse. Chuck Chekatov is with the Oregon Center for Public Policy.
Most of the federal tax cuts went to the wealthiest Oregonians. The tax cuts were targeted towards people who do not spend all of their money. Therefore, you're just lining the pockets of their savings accounts and not doing anything to stimulate Oregon's economy.
Chekatov says one of the reasons why the unemployment rate is so high in Oregon is due to an inflow of people. In 2002, the state's population increased to about 17,000 while maintaining the highest unemployment rate in the nation. Nationally, manufacturing has been the hardest hit sector of the economy. Since Bush took office, the sector lost 2.5 million jobs. In Oregon, non-durable manufacturing sector and high-tech manufacturing sector are two of four industries with significant job losses since 2001, along with construction and employment services, according to Chuck Chekatov. He says Oregon lost 45,000 jobs since the start of the recession in 2001, and 6,300 jobs are lost since the national recession was officially declared to be over. Michael Knight was laid off 2 years ago from a warehouse job and has been looking for the same type of work ever since.
With the amount of education I have, with all the additional requirements that the jobs have now, it's hard for me to find a job. They require more education than I got now.
Across the country, more than 9 million Americans are out of work, and many of the unemployed have used up their benefits. Although government reported economy grew at a 3.1% annual rate in the second quarter, job risk claims rose by 15,000 to 413,000 in the week ended August 30th. Employment growth at the moment is the lowest for any recovery since the government began keeping track in 1939. Chuck Chekatov says another federal extended benefit program is needed.
Unemployment insurance is an important but tenuous support in the communities. It helps not only the individuals who are unemployed, but it helps maintain the economy and the communities hurt by unemployment. It's been a huge life preserver for Oregonians and their communities.
Currently, the temporary extended unemployment compensation program is providing up to 13 weeks of extended unemployment benefits to workers who exhaust their regular benefits and up to 26 weeks in three high unemployment states. In mid-August, only three states, Oregon, Alaska, and Washington, were considered high unemployment states. The program expired on December 31, 2003. I'm Mia Kim for Free Speech Radio News.
Yesterday, an agreement was reached that would grant low-income seniors an annual subsidy of $600 to defray drug costs, allowing millions of older Americans to sign up for prescription drug cards offering discounts estimated at 15% or more. This as Congress continues the debate over the Senate Medicare bill and the proposed Equal Employment Opportunity Commission regulation. Joel Edelstein reports.
Since 1967, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, the ADEA, has required that employers provide their retirees who are old enough to qualify for Medicare with health benefits equal to those provided for their younger retirees. But that could change. Section 631 of the Medicare bill, approved by the Senate, amends the ADEA to allow employers to provide different levels of benefits. Section 631 was added with no discussion or debate just before the Senate approved it by a 76-21 vote. Bill Hogan is co-author of a story in the September issue of the AARP Bulletin.
The provision we're talking about, I think is fair to say, was written by lobbyists for trade associations representing employer interests, and those are big employer interests across the country. It's a stealth provision that made its way into this legislation in the 11th hour, and it took some really unraveling after the fact to figure out exactly what this provision would do.
Section 631 is supported by the HR Policy Association, which represents senior human resource executives at more than 200 of the nation's largest employers. According to Senior Vice President and General Counsel Daniel Yeager, change is needed to protect pre-Medicare retiree benefits.
The employer has to basically give the same benefits to people after they reach the age of 65 that they're giving to people, to retirees, before the age of 65. Faced with that, the employer has a choice of either expanding benefits for post-Medicare retirees or either cutting back or eliminating benefits for pre-Medicare retirees. Well, you know, with the costs of health care being what they are today, the concern is that most employers will take the latter course and actually reduce their pre-retiree health care benefits. I don't see in this day and age anyone being in a position where they can enhance their retiree benefits for people beyond the age of 65. It's just not affordable.
The AARP, the nation's largest advocate for senior citizens, opposes the change. According to David Certner, Director of Federal Affairs, the current law already allows employers to give retirees who receive Medicare less than they provide for those who do not yet qualify. He argues that Section 631 opens the way for age discrimination.
The age discrimination law currently allows you to take Medicare into account in determining whether or not you're giving equal benefits to those under 65 and those over 65. And of course, Medicare has substantial value. So if you're providing a benefit package to those under the age of 65, the employer only needs to supplement above and beyond the value of Medicare in order to provide equal benefits. So it's already less expensive to provide benefits to the over 65 population. Employers here want the flexibility to not provide benefit coverage at all, and that's part of the problem we have. We are trying to ensure continued good coverage for the Medicare-eligible population.
The Senate bill is now under consideration by a joint House-Senate conference committee. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has also proposed a rule change which would have the same effect as Section 631. The EEOC deadline for public comment on this rule is September 12th. I'm Joel Edelstein at KGNU in Boulder for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to FSRN. I'm Deepa Fernandez.